Hey everyone, Fraser here. So it's time for another interview with me, not an interview by me. And this time I was talking to the folks at Demystifying Science. And they do a YouTube stream, podcast. The quirk is that it's a couple of aliens who are humanologists. They're studying humanity and trying to figure out how we work. And so they're sort of in character. And of course, if you actually watch the video on YouTube, you'll see that I'm talking to a couple of puppets. It's a very surreal experience. But it was good. They were sort of seeing space exploration and sort of considering that as a way to alleviate some of the problems that we're having here on Earth, a place of unlimited potential that we can expand out into, as opposed to constantly dealing with the zero-sum situation of here on Earth. Pushed my conversation into some different places. We talked about cryptocurrency and sustainability and other things. So I hope you might enjoy the conversation. And anyway, so here's the interview, but you can check out their podcast. It's called Demystifying Science. And even if you just want to see me talk to a couple of puppets, you should check it out. All right, here's the interview.
So you are basically the William Randolph Hearst of space publishing.
Right. I need a bigger office, maybe.
Yeah, a castle. Do you have one of those gold pools?
No. Universe Today was started in my spare bedroom, and 22 years later, it is still run from my spare bedroom.
22 years. Is it the same bedroom?
No. I've gone through three bedrooms at this point.
How did you start it?
I've always been interested in space and astronomy. And in fact, when I went to high school, I took the journalism program at my school and did a column about what you could see in the night sky. I bought my own telescope. I organized star parties. I was really into space and astronomy. But then I went into engineering instead of astronomy. I'm not really sure why. That was what I got accepted. Yeah, that's what I got accepted into, I don't know, at UBC, and shifted into computer science and sort of worked in the software industry for a couple of years. And I just, you know, the internet was coming along, the web was coming along, and I wanted to really understand it better. And so I picked one of my hobbies at random, this thing that I'd always been doing, really interested in sharing astronomy knowledge, and ran this website on the side to learn more about just how the internet worked. Hmm. And it taught me that that's all I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so it was just a matter of getting out of the software field and into the space journalism field, which I guess kind of turned into, like, it is part software as well. So it all sort of, you know, scratches all the itches.
You mean in terms of the sort of programming that you do and running the website, or?
Yeah. Just, you know, I can't think of a field where the tools that you need to do your job are so complicated and completely different. So I am a writer and I also manage technical people, script in Unix, you know, like all of the different kinds of jobs. Like, it's very, very technical. To otherwise you have to pay for people, you know, big salaries that you can't afford, and so you just can't even do your job. If you have to hire a webmaster, you can't have a business, and so you have to learn to be a webmaster. You have to learn to upgrade WordPress and so on each time there's a new patch out, etc. So that's how I got into it in the first place, and just over time just learned more and more, got better and better, and just continued to write and hone my craft.
And so there's a big difference between an operation like Universe Today and something like, I don't know, Wired.
Yeah.
Were you ever tempted to move in that direction and to start building an empire, or was this a conscious choice to stay?
Yeah, no, never. In fact, so my experience in the software world, in the startup world, taught me everything I ever needed to know about that space, about what it's like to have investors, to the politics that are involved in that, how insufferable clients can be. So I really just vowed from day one that I was going to build Universe Today as a happiness factory for me and hopefully for whoever came on board with what we were doing. And so absolutely not. No, I consider that to be kind of anathema to what I'm trying to do. You know, whenever people reach out and be like, oh, we'd like to acquire you, I just say like, just go away, please. I'm not interested. Yeah. And I think it's definitely given me longevity. I've been able to sort of go through all of the cycles that have happened, rises and falls, the what's happened as different media companies have come out and vaporized. Just because at the end of the day, you know, if I have enough food to eat and I can write some words and I can find a spare bedroom, Universe Today goes on.
Were you surprised by the amount of interest in the subject matter? Because there was kind of a period in American history where people weren't that excited about space, right?
Yeah, I would say the real interest in space has only happened. I mean, there's always been an interest in space, but it really hasn't been since really Elon Musk, SpaceX, and this generation of excitement that has brought a lot of new people into the space world. So for the longest time, you know, there was a small dedicated community, and now it's definitely grown much larger.
Is that because it's become more practical as a future for humans?
Yeah, I think so. I think people are excited. I mean, partly I think people are just excited by advancement in technology. It's felt like we've stagnated in terms of space exploration for the longest time. I mean, it's been 60 years since the first person went into space, and it's been a little over 50 years since the last person walked on the moon.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Like, it seems like there was almost more technological progress back 50 years ago than right now, despite all of these incredible new companies and technologies.
No, absolutely not. Okay. No, it's not true at all. No, so back in the day, it was, you know, because there was the space race between the Americans and the Soviets, they were both willing to spend all the money that they had. the Americans spent $350 billion just on the Apollo program, and they spent a total of $500 billion during that period. Now, SpaceX has essentially is in the process of developing reusable rocketry as something they're able to do out of cash flow. So we're just, you know, what happened was between the US and the Soviets and even the Chinese and, you know, all these people that realized space exploration to send humans to other places was way too expensive. We just can't afford to do it. But the technology has been steadily increasing, getting better and better, faster. And now we're at the point where it is feasible for smaller companies, smaller organizations to carry this out. You see Rocket Lab, you see SpaceX, you see Blue Origin, and then there's probably dozens of other companies that I don't even know the names of who are in this space as well. So it really is a revolution at this point, and it's here to stay.
Now, are there other problems that are associated with having all these multiplayers in space? Like, you used to have just two superpowers, but are all of, you know, is it the fact that there's a swarm of actors out there?
Yeah.
Is that leading to other issues?
Well, I mean, I think in general, competition in a marketplace is a good thing. And so if you have two companies capable of landing reusable rockets, 10 companies capable of landing reusable rockets, that's a good thing. I think the danger is, in fact, that we're going to end up with a monopoly, that SpaceX with their Starship system, like if they actually figure this out, there is no competition on Earth. That overnight, if that spacecraft worked, it's going to demolish the entire existing space industry, because the cheapest rocket possible by an order of magnitude will also be the most powerful, most capable rocket. And there'll be no need to use literally anything else. So no, I'm worried that there isn't enough competition at this point.
But aside from the competition, what about just externalities like space junk and
Yeah.
This, you know, are these going to be real problems? Like,
yeah, I mean, it all sort of depends on the altitude. So the danger of space junk is the stuff that's actually at the middle and high altitudes. It's not the stuff that's low. Mm. So you look at something, you know, even the Starlinks, things that are say 500 kilometers high, these things are going to deorbit themselves within a couple of years. It's only through constant engine firing that they can even remain in orbit at all. The International Space Station is constantly trying to burn up into the atmosphere, and NASA has to keep boosting it back up. But once you get higher, you look at the stuff like the OneWeb, they're at like 800 kilometers. Some of the other stuff are at 1,000 kilometers plus. Now suddenly these things are going to be sticking around for decades, hundreds of years, thousands of years. And with the geostationary satellites, they're going to stay effectively forever. So really the danger is that people aren't flying their spacecraft low enough.
Gotcha. And is that they're losing forward velocity because of friction or something? Or?
Yeah, they're going through, they're in the atmosphere.
Gotcha. So if they were a little further out, they'd be like the moon. It wouldn't be a big problem. Like,
well, but then it is a problem because then they're up there forever. So you want these things to, because if you lose control with your satellite, then you want it to just crash back into the atmosphere and disappear and clean up after itself.
Gotcha.
But if you are 1,000 kilometers up or 2,000 kilometers up and you lose contact with your satellite, then you've left a piece of junk up there for 10,000 years. And it could, if it collides with any other random piece of junk, now you've made a million pieces of junk, each one moving at 28,000 kilometers per hour, which is a terrifying disaster. So, no, I think the best bet is fly low.
But there's no regulation about this, right? People are just kind of sticking stuff up there?
Yeah, no, there is no specific regulation. I mean, each country has its communications regulations. So in the US, you've got, what is it, the FCC? You know, we have our own version in Canada and so on. But there's no worldwide regulation, although there has definitely been a lot more conversation between the countries in terms of responsibilities of space junk and dealing with the externalities. And so,
and is the FCC in charge of orbital distance?
No, that's the FAA. So the FAA is in charge of the orbits and the FCC is in charge of telecommunications.
But hasn't it become kind of a popular thing to sort of show off your guns and blow something up remotely in space?
Yeah, well, the Indians just did that. They used an aircraft to launch a missile to blow up a satellite to demonstrate that they have the capability to destroy satellites. And it sent a spray of space junk into various orbits, some of which actually crossed the orbit of the International Space Station, leading to a potentially dangerous situation. So, yeah, but I mean, the Americans have done this, the Chinese have done this, the Russians have done this. This is a common practice to show we now have the ability to knock your satellites out of space.
And what are there in the way of solutions that you know about? Like, is anybody developing sort of ways to trawl up all that debris in the event that somebody acts irresponsibly?
Or maybe like a good old fashioned space war to like break everything apart and then vacuum it out.
Yeah. So I think what you're going to see is regulations that any company that's going to try to launch a satellite or any kind of space junk has to have a plan for the end of life, that you have a thruster on board that allows it to crash back into the atmosphere, or maybe it's got some kind of reel, a tether on it that it can play out that'll act like a big dragnet to slow it back down and bring it into the atmosphere.
So you humans will have end-of-life plans for your technology before you have really good end-of-life plans for yourselves?
Yeah, yes.
Will you have end-of-life plans for other technology, like car batteries or fishing nets or stuff like that?
I don't think so.
Can't bleed over?
No, I don't think it's very good end of life for any of this. You know, talk about externalities. I mean, there's so much of our modern economy is based on externalities that aren't factored in, and people could just get to enjoy the, the free lunch.
I guess what I'm saying is it'd be really cool if this set a precedent for that back on Earth.
Oh yeah, I think just in general for everything. I mean, I think there are some, like in Canada, we have to pay, like if I buy a new printer, I have to pay a couple of dollars to handle the environmental waste fee for this printer that I've bought.
Really?
So maybe that does exist in various fields. And so that's essentially, I'm paying to have that printer recycled in the end.
There's like a car company, like Rivian or something, is doing this as well, where they're promising their batteries will end up being sort of reappropriated towards solar cell storage, I believe.
Oh, cool. Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, I think it should be done just in general. Like, can you imagine if the plastic companies had to account for every molecule of plastic that they produce in the end, to have it back in their facility? It would change the nature of the amount of plastic that gets produced and the costs associated. And we as consumers wouldn't just go and buy a cheap plastic bag because it was going to cost us $5.
Yeah, and the fishing companies wouldn't just leave their nets out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So all that kind of stuff. I mean, again, like in many cases, the flaws in capitalism seem to come mainly from the unaccounted externalities,
right,
which is kind of enraging.
Have you heard any of
deal with climate change? Well, I was going to say, just as we deal with climate change, I mean, just like pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
And God knows what else.
Yeah. And absolutely, yeah. And we're having to face the consequences of it. And yet, whoever pumped it out in the first place doesn't have to pay to remove every last carbon dioxide atom or molecule.
It's not even clear that you could remove a lot of these molecules, too. I mean, carbon dioxide's at least inert, but there's like some really gnarly stuff that's...
Oh, yeah, totally.
We're reading about every day on Earth. So... it's interesting. We actually talked to a lady who is running a startup where she's kind of proposing a circular loop economy for heavy metals, where they're mined out of the earth and every atom is essentially traced using blockchain tech.
That's cool.
It's a pretty long distance plan, but...
Right. Like NFTs for garbage.
Well, they're actually looking for these polymetallic nodules in order to be able to mine rare earth metals from the bottom of the ocean. So, because they have this plan where they're going to find these really pure chunks of metal, hoover them up from the bottom of the ocean, and then basically provide all of the rare earth metals that humans are going to need for the next ever, and account for them through blockchain.
That's really cool. I like that idea. When you think about it, like depending on the energy use of the blockchain as you're trying to maintain this more environmentally friendly method of tracking, but absolutely. I mean, you can even imagine that you have a barcode put on some item, and then you just try to make sure that you can follow that item back, and whoever was the one who built it in the first place, they're responsible for the end of life of it. That's interesting. I mean, it's funny, you know, I'm a huge fan of blockchain and Bitcoin and crypto in general, and it's going to be interesting to see how this stuff all turns into practical uses in our lives, as opposed to just, you know, people to try and speculate and get rich.
There will always be that.
But yeah, sure.
Well, I always think about it. So I was reading about the gold rush, and most of the people who went and mined gold weren't very rich at the end of the day.
The people who sold the shovels.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And this reminds me of a similar thing where I'm like, who here is selling the shovels?
Yes.
And I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I think we see a bunch of shovel sellers popping up. In fact, Coinbase is going to be going public tomorrow for hundreds of billions of dollars. So, you know, there's a shovel seller.
That's just infrastructure for...
Yeah, just a place to go and buy and sell and keep track of your Bitcoins. So,
the new Wall Street?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I maybe. I mean, it's not even that. I mean, again, shovels.
So with the move towards blockchain, do you think that it's going to replace money and traditional financial systems? This is kind of out of the left field.
Yeah, but... we are way outside of my specialty here. So
time for wild speculation. You like computers, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. In space.
Bitcoin in space.
I mean, I think if anyone who follows what happened with Bitcoin, I mean, they had this crisis a couple of years ago where they were sort of trying to consider the size of the blocks, and the small block won out so that anyone who wants to run a node can keep track of the entire transaction ledger, as opposed to it being just so big that only large institutions can do that. And what that did was force large transactions to be the norm, that you're only really going to move around a big transaction. And so then what you're going to see is smaller transactions being done on top of that, or just done in regular currencies. And so if I'm going to buy a house, maybe I will transfer you the Bitcoin for it. But if I'm going to buy a candy bar, then I'm still going to just use you Canadian dollars. And I think you can sort of imagine the two working hand in hand and there being various translations. But will a cryptocurrency end up being the future of all? I mean, it seems impossible that it won't be some kind of digital currency in the future. I mean, again, here in Canada, we are like, I haven't held cash for months. Like, we just use our Interac cards and we just beep boop on the little terminal and money's pulled out of our account. And then you can imagine that being connected in some way in and out of your larger Bitcoin store. Who knows?
Well, it seems like the value of a standard currency is that some government is speaking up for it. I mean, somebody big and powerful is like, hey, we got your back if, you know, it's good.
Right. Or on the flip side, hey, we'll print twice as much and devalue the currency. So that's, I mean, it absolutely, if a country can maintain do a good job with their currency, then the need for some kind of external non-inflationary coin is fine, is unnecessary. But if they get a little greedy, then it makes sense to have something that you're not impacted by that.
In space.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, as y'all move into space, as you actually move out there and people start, I don't know what sort of structures you imagine. We talked to, Isaac?
This has to disrupt the nation at some point, right?
I was actually going to say, I wonder if it's just an opportunity to try out lots of different systems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what you're going to see for sure, is you're going to see people attempting different digital coins, trying different solutions, seeing what works, what doesn't work, mad speculation, throwing ideas out. And then in the end, we'll end up with whatever made the most sense all along.
Very evolutionary.
Yeah, but we can't know. Yeah, exactly. It's evolutionary biology. We can't know in advance. But I do think, I mean, anyone who's like still rolling their eyes at the concept of cryptocurrency, like, I hope they at least start like going, okay, maybe now I'll learn how it works.
Maybe now I'll invest a little bit.
Yeah, why? I mean, who knows about that? I mean, I'm not going to provide investment advice to anybody.
That's it. In space.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess if humans expand outwards, and you cover space phenomena from the standpoint of astronomy, but you also kind of talk about the philosophy of space exploration, what it means for humans to leave the planet, what it means to take care of this planet. And it seems like going into space is going to create a situation where the corporation is the most important unit, at least for a while, right? So if Elon Musk starts a Mars colony.
Like more than a nation. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's already kind of starting to happen on Earth, as far as I can tell. But if Elon Musk starts a Mars colony and he has 1 million employees on Mars, and that's the only life on Mars is people employed by Elon Musk.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, before we go into kind of the ethics and that of space exploration, you know, let's assume that this solar system is completely dead and devoid of life, and we don't have to worry about, you know, are we going to step on a bug.
The Martian conversation is separate.
Yeah, exactly. Fill the Europa with cyanobacteria, and so that everywhere we go, all we see is just Earth-based cyanobacteria, and we've wiped out all evidence of any native Martian life. And that is I consider that to be an enormous question and one that needs to be fully answered before we take the next step and fill Mars with our filthy, filthy Earth life.
That was a problem with the Apollo missions too, from what I understand.
All of it. I mean, we've already dumped Earth life, Earth bacteria, contaminated all kinds of locations, some of which the life may have gotten a toehold. So
personally, I think that humans are basically highly sentient bacterial biofilms. So right. There's yeah, not really a way for you to go anywhere and not do that.
It's literally impossible to clean a spacecraft. Even if you try, if you take every part and put it into an autoclave and cook it and radiate it and do your best, there's still going to be bacteria on board that not only can survive the trip to Mars, but can thrive on the surface of Mars.
Spores are amazing, yeah.
Yeah, spores, the like lichens can live on Mars. We are completely rabbit holing, so we've got to remember to get back to your original question. But
this is how this usually goes. It's
yeah, okay. Yeah. There was an experiment they put on the International Space Station where they put these different life forms into a bunch of different boxes, and then they exposed these life forms to the vacuum of space for a couple of years. So they got the vacuum, they got the cold, they got the sunlight, they got the radiation, they got the whole package, the whole space unpleasantness package. And then they brought these life forms back to Earth, and they put some of them, it just brought them back to Earth and just opened up and saw how they did. They put others into a simulated Mars environment. And what they found was many of the hardy life forms that they had chosen were perfectly fine to go back to being alive on Earth. But more terrifyingly, some of them were perfectly happy to start spreading on Mars. And so you take a cyanobacteria, you send it to space, you expose it to the hard vacuum of space for 5 years, you then put it on Mars, and it's just like ready to go. Like, Mars is fine. Let's get to it.
Life is amazing.
Life is amazing. Yeah, that'll find a way. So assuming that the entire solar system is just completely dead rock, then the question you're asking is like, what does the future of civilization look like on Mars? And I actually argue that
self-governance, something like self-governance.
Yeah, I actually think that is not a problem that needs to be solved and is not going to be a concern for a very long time. Mm. Because Mars is awful. Right? That like Antarctica is a place that is 1,000 times more habitable than Mars. And anyone who actually goes to Mars is going to be just struggling for existence all the time. And the only way they're going to be able to eke out any kind of survival is with constant shipments coming from Earth to support them. Mm-hmm. And really the only thing that's sustainable over any period of time is a teeny tiny research station supported by the economy of an entire nation state. Mm-hmm. And so you're not going to have a city of a million people on Mars having a good time living that Mars life. You're going to have a group of 6-12 astronauts in a very cramped station on Mars with constant shipments giving them more of the precious things that they require to not starve, get irradiated, suffocate, or go get space madness for a very long time. Like, we are looking at, I think, decades, possibly more than 100 years.
Why do you think it's so long? I mean,
awful.
But what about the Biosphere project? Biosphere 2, the one where they locked themselves in that house with, you know, all of the ecosystems that they wanted. Couldn't you just build an enormous biosphere on Mars and then just live a perfect VR life?
As you said those words, that sounds simple?
It doesn't sound simple, but it does sound possible. It also doesn't sound simple to reuse rockets, right?
Right. So reusing rockets is vastly simpler than attempting to recreate the environment of Earth on another planet.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just like, I think, like, and what do you get? Like, let's say you
glory.
Do it. You get, yeah, glory, yeah.
Tesla sales.
You've painstakingly at enormous expense. Yeah, at enormous expense made a place that's like a crappy Earth.
Yes.
That's, you did it.
Yes.
You know, victory. And so, you know, we've seen many examples of people who, with their rugged individualism, have gone off to the extreme places on Earth to carve out a, you know, a solitary existence. There are places on the coast of Antarctica. There are old villages that people tried to live, eating penguins and shivering to death.
Wow.
And they all fail because there's only so much that just the excitement and the adventure of moving to a place that's that hostile and extreme. will carry you, and then you just get sad and cold and you just want to go home and you just want to have a burrito and you just want to see the ocean and you just want to, you know what I mean? And well, I guess you get to see the ocean in Antarctica. Well, there's a lot of ice. Who knows?
So, not on Mars though, point stands.
Not on Mars, exactly. There's no trees. There's no ocean. There's just being underground, trying to not have your burrow leak into the thin atmosphere of Mars. And so
sounds
I really
like
think
a Philip K. Dick book or something.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. And so every moment on Mars is gonna be a desperate chance for survival. All the time. So, and
go ahead.
But so can I say we see this kind of situation happen all the time where we try to go and live in places that are beyond our capability technologically and it's just suffering and retreat.
Like Las Vegas?
Well, yeah, I guess. until our technology trivializes the experience. And so Las Vegas is only habitable. New Mexico is only, you know, in large amounts because of our technology, our air conditioning technology, et cetera. And so once we have sufficient technology, once we've cracked that biosphere concept, then these places suddenly do become viable. Then that's when you're going to need to have that conversation. But we are so far away from having technology that can actually trivialize. Not like even, like we, as I said, we could keep a small amount of people alive, a science station, some astronauts to learn the fascinating history of Mars, but we cannot support large numbers of people just want to go there and just, you know, try their hand at pioneering the red planet.
Well, it's interesting because way back we talked to this guy named Dennis Wingo. Do you know him? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we talked to Dennis Wingo and he mentioned during our conversation that his greatest dream was to have cruise ships that ply the skies between Earth and Mars. And talking about the Antarctica version of events.
Big time space tourism.
Big time space tourism, but there's also the shift has happened in Antarctica as well. Like on Earth, you can go get a cruise and go float around the North Seas and the South Seas and go look at the penguins and the polar bears.
Yeah. And I think that's a case of technology trivializing this adventure. So 20 years ago, it was a very dangerous thing to do. 100 years ago, it was a deadly thing to do. And now it's a thing that it's mostly uncomfortable when you're in 50-foot seas in a fairly small boat and you're wondering if this might be the wave that takes you out. I think we will get to a point where our technology trivializes that adventure, but we're not there. We're a long way away from there. And I think people are anticipating that Mars is going to be easier to live on than ever. But let's say we do get to that point, that we are trivializing it. Well, I think then that it's not SpaceX, it's not Elon Musk's job to run this weird corporation where people come and become indentured servitude, you know, on the surface of Mars. Like, he is going to provide the transportation. Hmm. You pay him $100,000, you buy a ticket to Mars. What you do on Mars, that's your problem. So I don't think, you know. You know, what happens on Mars stays on Mars. Anyway, mostly the suffering.
And so do you and all your children.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so I really feel like people, again, are sort of putting more emphasis on what Elon Musk is going to do. Elon Musk is going to sell tickets for people to go to Mars until people don't want to buy tickets anymore. And that number won't take long. And there will be a lot of people who are going to want to come back. So he's going to be selling return tickets to Mars, and many people are going to use them, and eventually people will stop wanting to go live on Mars.
You know, it's interesting. Mine. Everest has gotten more and more popular.
That's a good point.
I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, absolutely. You ever been there? For sure. I haven't been there. but it's like, but is there a city on Everest?
Not yet. At the top.
Is there like a, can you, you know, do there people who want to live up on the top of Everest?
Well, as far as I can tell, it's a pretty small space, right?
Still,
you could level it
and build like
Everest.
A nice observation, build like a nice little village up there.
Give it 100 years.
I'll bet you we have the technology today to level the top of Everest, build a village, and offer people condos at the highest place on Earth.
You could probably make a lot of money off that.
I think he would, from the beginning, it would be exciting. And then people would just, you know, as they had to constantly use canned oxygen, they were cold all the time, wind gusts of hundreds of kilometers an hour. They would be sick of it. It'd be time to go somewhere warm.
It's fascinating that you point this out, because I think about this in terms of something like backpacking, which is a fringe pursuit on Earth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's specifically for this reason. Going out into nature tends to be uncomfortable. Like, that's kind of the definition.
Absolutely. I do a ton of backpacking and hiking here where I live on Vancouver Island. It's like the paradise of it. And it is a deeply uncomfortable, kind of painful experience that does give you these momentary highs when you're like, look at that lake. Now I have to walk home, you know? And your whole day is spent keeping yourself alive. In terms of finding water, boiling the water, preparing your food, setting up camp, taking down camp, moving to the next location. Like, you are not watching television. You are working all day long, and then you pass out, and then you work out all day long the next day. And that is, I think that's, and so that, again, I think is a perfect analogy of what it's going to be like to live on Mars, except you also can't breathe. So yeah, no, I think, you know, people say like, oh, you don't want to live on Mars. I'm like, no way do I want to live on Mars.
But you'd go visit, right?
Yeah, I would go visit if it was quick. I'd go to the moon if it was quick.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, what are the baby steps? Is the moon a baby step? Are there going to be
totally
tourist orbital stations? Are there these cylinder things that people are talking about?
Yeah, maybe. I think the future holds, we're going to have a research station in Antarctica. We're going to have a research station in orbit, one on the moon and one on Mars. That is as living in space as humanity is prepared to get until, again, their technology trivializes it.
But I imagine that when technology does trivialize it, and obviously this is in the realm of sci-fi, but I'm thinking of the O'Neill cylinders that Mickey mentioned. It seems like you'll just have Las Vegas, but in space.
Totally. Right? Again, and once it's trivialized, and I think that's a great, like, you want to talk about decreasing the externalities on planet Earth. Yeah. Like, head up into a big O'Neill cylinder in space and float away into the L4 point.
Industry, you know? Too. You know, there's some talk of moving really gnarly stuff out there, too, where you can take advantage of the vacuum and perhaps.
Yeah, 100%. I always say that gravity wells are for suckers. So if you're going to leave the gravity well of Earth, why go into another gravity well like Mars? Like, definitely go live in your O'Neill cylinder. But that is still a 100-year plus future endeavor that's going to take an enormous amount of infrastructure in space. That we are nowhere near this. We're not going to have anything remotely similar to this for a very long time.
And so is there some kind of delusion about how close you are to it? Or what's going on right now?
Have you ever watched the television show Alone?
No.
No? There's a television show Alone where there's people who sign up for this to go into sometimes the Canadian wilderness, other places around the world, and they have to keep themselves alive for some period of time. And then whoever can survive the longest then gets to
go hang out with people.
They get a prize. They're famous. They get a prize. And just what you could just watch it play out. Like, they just start in the beginning. They're like, this is the best. I'm going to have so much fun. I love to fish. And then, you know, 60 days in, they're just like, I'm so sad. I'm so alone. No. I just miss human beings. I just want a cheeseburger. This is the worst. And I think that we don't have personal experience for how awful and difficult it's going to be to live in space. And so we romanticize it. All we've got is what Star Trek, Star Wars and other science fiction has told us what living in space is going to be like. And so we have no direct evidence to help manage our expectations for what it's going to be like.
Yeah, there's not a lot of media, it seems like, about the transition.
What do you mean by transition?
Well, the Star Trek is a version of humanity that is basically perfect. and is out exploring the stars. I mean, short of perfect, obviously, but
yeah.
I'm thinking...
the future is already optimized.
And the future is optimized.
They've already sorted out their utopia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it seems like there's not a lot of fictional templates for humans to consider what it would mean to go out into space now, except for maybe, I don't know, reading the journals of Lewis and Clark.
Yeah. So the problem is that I think it's science fiction is actually fantasy, that Star Trek is actually Lord of the Rings. Mm. And that the Enterprise is Gandalf or something. I'm trying to come up with some kind of analogy. And so, yeah, every problem is solved by magic. Mm. And
replicators.
Replicators are magic. Teleporters are magic. A device, a personal device you hold in your hand that allows you to communicate.
And magic. Figure out medical problems immediately.
Yeah, magic. Exactly. Magic. We don't actually have any really good. I mean, there are some people magic. That do hard sci-fi. The Expanse is pretty good.
But it's also past this point. The Expanse, mm-hmm. they've already gone one. Into the space world. They're already
and
on Mars.
They have magic.
Yes.
In terms of their engine.
A lot of magic, especially when magic. You get to the aliens.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't have a lot of people that are providing practical examples of what it's like because it's kind of boring.
Right? Do you think it's also that people are just really torn up about what's happening on Earth right now and all their sort of
that whole argument like just doesn't make any sense. Like people are like super mad at Elon Musk because he's going to try to abandon Earth to go to Mars. And then all the billionaires are going to go to Mars. But like literally any billionaire who wants to go to Mars, good riddance, because because Earth is the best. That you could have the most beautiful, amazing habitat on Mars, and it still would be sad, lonely, cold, asphyxiating misery compared to the most hostile place on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I would be more worried that Bezos would ship everybody else off to Mars and keep the place for himself.
Yeah, maybe. But again, you know, it's like sending humans to space is expensive. But
for now.
Maybe not as expensive as keeping them, though.
Yeah, so I think that...
If you just start shooting them into the sun,
the sun is the hardest place to get to in the solar system.
Really?
Is that true?
Yeah.
It's definitely the hottest place to get to.
It's the hottest, but you have to... the Earth is going 30 kilometers per second around the sun. And so in order to fall into the sun, you have to cancel out that 30 kilometers per second. Mm. And so you literally could go... It's easier to go to interstellar space than it is to go to the sun.
Wow, is that true? That's amazing.
Yeah.
I guess we'll find out in a second.
Seriously. I've always had this... I want someone to write this book, which is the rich billionaires leave Earth... realize that it sucks everywhere else, and then a few generations later come back and are perceived on Earth to be aliens that are abducting humans.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, we need to learn how to take care of this planet. We need to get our affairs organized here, that there is no place that we can go to escape what we're doing to the planet, what's to come, and you know, for whatever 7.5 billion people, there's nothing but working together to make this planet better. And there are a lot of things. I mean, I'm a huge fan of all of the technology, of the miniaturization that's going on, the renewable energy that's being developed, the shift to electrification. There's a lot of really great things that are moving in the right direction. And we just need to keep figuring that out and getting better at it.
In addition to the Earth
won't help. Mm.
Totally. That's really interesting. So what about the idea that people kind of take care of the Earth with how they spend their money too? Like, how do you incentivize people to not destroy the other side of the planet with their purchasing power?
Well, I think that asking people to take personal responsibility for some of the large scale problems that are happening to the planet is kind of a shift of the blame, that in fact, a lot of the issues have to be dealt with at a governmental level. And to sort of make people take personal responsibility is kind of a sneaky way to not take responsibility at for the companies, the corporations, the countries, etc. And so
so like people, you know, should you just think people should just be expected to spend the least amount of money no matter the impact? Or
well, no, I'm saying if you're going to try to tell a person try to minimize the use of plastic bags, or the country just says okay, plastic bags are no longer allowed to be made in our country, like one cuts it off at the source, the other puts an unfair amount of responsibility on the hands of the individuals. And I think it's a way for the people who are doing the causes of the problems to sort of shift the responsibility away from themselves.
We've been talking about this a lot, and it does seem to break down along two different lines, right? So on one hand, definitely industrial levels of pollution should be stopped at the source. But then there's this other aspect, which is that if people don't take personal responsibility, it'll be replaced by something else that sucks too.
Yeah, but in general, we're incentivized to take various actions by 1,000 cuts every day. And you often don't even know the implications. Is it better to use a disposable styrofoam container? Is it better to wash your plate? We don't know. Scientists sometimes don't even know the final answer to this question. And so how can we be expected on tens of thousands of individual decisions every day to always make the right ones that move planet Earth in the right direction, while at the government and corporate level, they have scientists, their job is to determine what's the best way to do this kind of thing, and they can institute policies that do it in a much more sweeping way that's better for society. In my opinion,
I think they kind of work together. Like, it's not about perfection; it's about sort of just doing the best you can. And I sort of see what you're saying. Like, no matter how much responsibility people take, if corporations are allowed to exploit people's weaknesses, then they're always going to sort of exceed to some extent.
It's just shifting the blame. It's just saying, you know, the earth is messed up because you didn't sort your recycling. If you had just sorted your recycling, we wouldn't have global warming, but it's your fault.
I wonder about the personal biases that are involved in all of these decision makings. Have you seen the graph of despair?
No.
The graph of despair is a graph of people's responses to the question of, are humans responsible for climate change? Right. And so the y-axis is, oh goodness,
I'm going to Google it.
The y-axis is how many people say yes or no, and the x-axis is science literacy.
Right.
And
I think
Julia
Galef has it on her Twitter.
And it's Dan Kahan who came up with it. So if you Google Dan Kahan graph of despair,
okay,
you should be able to find it.
Okay.
But the basic idea.
The basic idea is that as you increase science literacy, you don't actually see people agreeing along political lines.
Right.
Conservatives become more and more certain that humans are not responsible for climate change, and liberals become more and more certain that they are, despite increases in science literacy. Hence, graph of despair.
Right. It's pretty tough when, you know, as a person who's a fan of science, my preference is that we just listen to the scientists and.
But the people that are most learned about science, depending on their political orientation, come up with different answers. That's the crazy part.
Yeah, that's mad.
And the Academy selects for one type of political orientation.
Right. So most scientists in the Academy are on the left. And so what something that I think about all the time is, like, how do you bring conservative science into the fold? Is conservative science an oxymoron?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Is that a? I mean, in theory, science should be apolitical, right? Because literally, you're listening to what nature is saying. So, how could you have a politic as it relates to the science? The only politics you could have is when you're attempting to
technologize
the science into your own personal agenda.
Well, but science is about
science
explanation.
And technology are kind of mixed up. On Earth?
Like, science and technology are mixed up, but science is also about you look at information and you come up with a story.
Well, I think, I mean, science is about coming up with a hypothesis and then attempting to disprove your hypothesis. And the longer your hypothesis fails to disprove, then the more likely your hypothesis matches reality.
But that's a story about the world that scientists have, right?
Well, that is a description of the scientific method, yes. Sure.
And the scientific method is the hypothesis in the first place is motivated by a personal vision of how the world works.
Well, I mean, I think that my experience with the scientific method is seemingly a very productive way to examine nature. Of all of the different ways of knowing, science seems to be the one that brings us the internet and the ability to.
Yeah, it's really good at making technology for sure.
Yeah, yeah, but then it's really good at explaining dinosaurs, and it's really good at explaining how the interior of the sun works, and it's really good. So it first figures out these kind of basics of the way nature, at the end of the day, it's trying to figure out how nature functions. Mm. And then we adapt that discoveries made in science into technology, into actual engineering. Mm. And
seems like that's the political moment, though, is when it's like being armed towards some service, you know, in service of some outcome, really.
Yeah, I mean, any technology that you come up with has good, you know, can be used for good or evil. Here we are having a delightful conversation across the internet using digital cameras and so on. And then at the same time, people have weaponized the internet to sow mistrust and all kinds of dysfunction and conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would I be willing to give up the internet in exchange for people not spreading conspiracy theories? No. No, that is the price that we have to pay. And I think
probably good for your ecosystem informationally that, you know, conspiracies are investigated in general. I mean, it seems like every once in a while one turns out to be true or something.
Yeah, well,
it's
maybe.
It's like a 1 to 10 or 1 to 50 ratio. But
Yeah. That's the problem with conspiracy theories is that sometimes they're true. you know, my it's funny. I used to play this game with my kids. We used to call this Snopes. And so we would go onto the Snopes website, read a myth, and then it would be the kids' job to figure out whether the thing was true or not.
I love that.
Build their skepticism. Yeah, they loved it. They thought it was super fun because things are so weird. And you'd be like an alligator.
Such a good skill for kids too to develop. Yeah. Like get a sense for that. Yeah.
So skepticism is vital. It's kind of amazing how much that you have to use that skepticism muscle in your daily life. And now, I mean, it's funny. Like I'll watch something on the internet, and my son will come by and he goes, "Oh, that's a scam." I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, look, like, you know, and he shows all these little signs that tell you that this person isn't telling the truth or whatever.
That's amazing.
And it's because he's built up such a powerful BS detector through having to interact day in, day out with all the obnoxiousness on the internet. So I do think that we are kind of breeding a new generation of people who are a lot more immune. I think that the downsides that we are trying to solve the downsides collectively as a society, and the rise of extremism on the internet seems to have been, you know, we can see the social media companies responding with banning people, coming up with new rules and regulations, developing technology to try and catch stuff earlier. It feels like an immune system is forming. Mm. both societally and technologically, that it's going to try to prevent and minimize. But it's always a give and take, you know, virus versus antivirus.
Well, and there's also the question of who forms the immune system, because on the level of your son figuring out how to detect BS, that seems like a really healthy mechanism. But if you had raised your kid and never exposed them to anything that was faulty information or poorly put together, I imagine that he wouldn't have that ability.
Well, I think he's kind of honed it on his own with his interactions with the internet, less so with my teaching. I think it's a lot more. The internet has been a better father than
I have. You're so modest. Wow.
Yeah. That's nature versus nurture, right?
Yeah, exactly. Internet.
You know, it's really interesting, though, because, like, conspiracyism, or whatever you want to call it, is a sort of skepticism at heart, right? It's, like, sort of, like, gone a little, at least in many cases, it's kind of gone over the edge. But there's 100%. A fine line, because skepticism does form the bedrock of science on your planet.
Yeah, 100%. That experience of a person believing, like a flat earther, being absolutely certain that there is this conspiracy. They are skeptical of all of these claims that are being made by NASA and science and so on. It looks precisely the same, but it's like been somehow slightly corrupted to lead to an entirely different conclusion.
It's fascinating.
It's kind of fascinating and horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it seems a reflection of people's frustration with the systems. Left and right, authoritarian and libertarian, everyone's a little freaked out.
Yeah, I think you can talk to each conspiracy theorist, you can suss out what is their worldview, and then use that as a basis to understand the way they're perceiving various situations that are happening, and across all levels of the political spectrum. And so I do think that worldview informs the way you perceive these events.
Has that been a challenge as you've developed Universe Today? Did you have a lot of people showing up and being like, we've never been to the moon?
Oh yeah, totally. You know, like, it's weird to get death threats.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh yeah, lots. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone who's in this field has had their share of death threats. There's women get it a lot worse.
Mm.
I mean, just absolutely. And yet all you're doing is like, I love space. And like, I want you to die. Like, what?
Have you ever taken any of them seriously? Or you figure that it's just people mouthing off?
Do you have to, like, take
off
these people to court?
No, I haven't taken it that seriously, but there was a couple of people who have been so sort of serious that people have taken them to court. People have gotten restraining orders against them. There's a couple of people who've been sort of lurking around this community who have had to have the police called on them a couple of times, for
sure.
Wow. Yeah. So you know, a lot of it is just this spam and unrequested comments made on videos and stories that we do and so on that I just delete.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not going to have an argument with you about whether or not the Earth is flat. I'm here to talk about space. I love space. The people who want to talk about space can, and the people who want to just have a different conversation, like, go start your own site, have your own forum. You guys can argue amongst it about yourselves. If you come over to my community, then you're just marketing. You're just trying to promote your own nonsense in my house.
Yeah. Sort of like you have to behave yourself in someone else's house.
Yeah. I think in the beginning, you try to be really, you know, gracious, and you're like, you know, you try to patiently explain, but they're not even having a conversation in good faith. They just want to bog down your time. They just want to make you sad and try to sow dissent in the people who are the fans of what you're doing. And
right.
So a lot of the times you just, after a while, you're just like, this is taking away the time that I could be spending talking about new discoveries at Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
And I have limited time in the day. So
has it been pretty easy for you to sort of cut the trolls out of your life? Or attempted to ever just...
No, I mean, you kind of have to be remorseless about it. You just have to go like, this is like, you have a vision for the kind of community that you want to create. And I want a community where people are nice for starters.
Kind to one another.
Yeah. Yeah. That are kind and polite to each other. And then we share this. Yeah. Then we share this common interest that we want to talk about, but you have to have both of those. If you want to come and talk about Bitcoin on my space community, then there's the door. And if you want to be, an asshole and talk about space, there's the door. But if you can be nice, talk about space, then you're welcome.
Well, and it's really interesting because I feel like for most of human evolution, y'all probably had to behave yourselves or else you'd get punched in the face or thrown out of the village or something. And this is like the first time you've had to deal with this concept of complete anonymity. It's sort of
totally.
What do you think about that? Like,
yeah, you wonder how many of these trolls would keep this, would they say this to your face? Yeah, after they got a smack in the nose or whatever. Overall, I think that the ability to be anonymous on the internet is important and a good thing, because I think about journalists, I think about people who live in societies where they need to be able to reach out and communicate and share their experiences and find help and realize that they're not alone. And I think that that is really important. And we need to make sure that we can protect that. And I don't think that if you force every person to give their identification, you can protect that. But I also think that there needs to be a way that a person doesn't get to just wipe the slate clean each time they've strayed too far and made too many rape threats, and then they need to go and start a new account and start all over again. I think that behavior needs to be able to follow you around the internet as you go. And so I think it's a technology problem that hasn't just been sorted out yet.
I'd like anonymity as a privilege rather than a right.
I think you're exactly right on that. That it is a privilege that you get for behaving yourself and using that great power very responsibly.
We have so many things that we would love to keep talking to you about, but we've already taken a lot of your time.
At some point, we'll talk about space. I got a few more minutes if you need.
Have a question, Quinn?
No.
Well, I usually like to ask all the humans at the end of the meeting, I like to find out what you think is the biggest threat to your species coming up in the next either 5 minutes or 100 years, or what sort of things, what sort of big problems, could be little problems, I guess, not even in your professional opinion, but just what do you see that you think humans are really going to have to keep an eye on going forward?
Well, I'll give you sort of the space answer to this, which is that, you know, one of the weirdest things that we see is this, us wondering why there are no aliens, apart from you, obviously, but we haven't seen any other aliens out there in the universe, and it's very puzzling. You feel like they should be everywhere. They should be filling the Milky Way with their robotic space
down on Earth.
Yeah, they're arriving by the day, and then they're setting up robotic factories and building more robots. And they're going off, flying off to other planets, and to just the entire solar system should be filled with these self-replicating robot probes, and yet we don't see any of them. We don't see evidence at all that there's anything out there in the universe. And so the one possibility is that we're alone. The other possibility, the more unsettling possibility, is that something terrible happens to every one of those civilizations when they reach a certain level of technological advancement. And it's like you don't know what it might be, that we are at a point where we are just a couple of hundred years away from being able to take that step out into space, to be able to start sending our probes out to other star systems. And yet, because we don't see that happening from anywhere else, we are at the precipice of whatever comes next. And
you just don't know how to be invisible yet.
Maybe. Yeah. That's the other possibility is key, is being invisible, but all of them all the time. And their spacecraft never break down, and the invisibility cloak goes down for a moment while they pass through the atmosphere. I don't know. I don't buy it.
What about those little Tic Tac thingies? Did you see that in New York Times?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. There's videos. Yeah.
We got to go refuel those things, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but don't get me started on UFOs. They're in the next name.
Time. Next time.
Unidentified flying objects. They're perfectly named. They're unidentified. If you identify them as aliens, well, then they're not unidentified anymore.
Well, if you don't know what it is, I think you have a responsibility to speculate wildly.
Well, at least that appears to be what everybody's doing. But yeah, so I think the threat is, we don't know what the threat is. Mm. And so we need to be vigilant for all of them. Yeah. And most likely to be the one that we can't predict. And so we do need to
be adaptive.
We have to adapt. We have to take care of our planet. We have to consider deeply the kinds of existential risks that we face and try to come up with solutions sooner than later.
Right. Beautiful. On. Well, thank you, Frederick Kane.
Thank you very
much. No problem. It's been really fun. Happy to do it. All right.
Bye. Take care.
Thanks.